This is Tips from the Top, a Perry Marketing production. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Tips from the Top, a monthly podcast presented by Perry Marketing for B2B software and technology entrepreneurs, marketers, and salespeople. Perry Marketing is a full-service B2B digital marketing agency with a keen focus and deep roots in enterprise technology and software marketing. We understand how software is purchased within enterprise technology organizations, and we know how to market it.
Hello, everyone. I'm Jamie Hood, the creative director at Perry Marketing. Joining me today is Tony Perry. Tony is the CEO and chief software advocate at Perry Marketing. Tony, before we get started, I want to congratulate you on being named an IBM ZOS champion this year. That is a great accomplishment, as there were just over 700 champions named globally.
Thank you, Jamie. I do think it's an honor, not just for me, but for the company as well, for Perry Marketing. I've been doing this marketing technology stuff for about 25 years. I've been working with IBM for about 13 of those. Yeah, I had a great sponsor in Reg Harbeck, who nominated me. I had some really good references that I put in with guys I've worked with over the years, and they must have said some really good things about me, and it really is an honor to be a champion, and I'll wear the badge proudly.
With us today is Rich Rudner. Rich has a long and storied career as a director of marketing and corporate communications, chief communications officer, and serial entrepreneur. Rich has helped start over a dozen businesses over the years, many of which are still in business today. Rich considers himself a user advocate and jack of all trades in the marketing and communications space. We're thrilled to have Rich join us to share his in-depth knowledge of marketing, communications, and content development. Rich, welcome.
Thanks very much, Jamie, and hello to you and to Tony as well. I'm delighted to be here.
Rich, you've had a long and successful career. Talk about the things you think have made you successful over the years.
Well, you said the most important one, because I always considered myself a user advocate and a jack of all trades, but a master of one. And that is finding the right people to put in the right situation so they can all be successful and therefore make our clients and our businesses successful. And that approach is something I still use today. In fact, I do what we call UAT, user acceptance protocols, in various websites to make sure that the users can use them easily. It doesn't make any sense to put something out there if people can't use them. And marketing today, you have to get to somebody immediately and get their attention in ways that you didn't have to do many years ago, but now it requires a great deal of expertise more than ever in both traditional and contemporary, and what I like to think of as futuristic marketing applications. Otherwise, you're going to be just left in the dust.
You brought up something great there, Rich, talking about the way things were done in the past. Let's talk about the evolution of technology marketing, say from the year 2000 to today. How have you seen things change? How is the CMO of today different from, say, 10, 12, 15 years ago?
Well, technology marketing, or MarTech as we like to think of it, has changed quite dramatically. In fact, you can say it's night and day. From back in 2000, you were still in what I like to think of as the early stages of web and related sales development. To today, we have a staggering array of revenue-generating software and related analytics. You know, in some ways, the job might be considered easier, but in reality, it's really much more difficult because it requires really multi-level expertise in, as I said, traditional, contemporary, and futuristic marketing applications. And that's where the great difference is. So you have a lot more things available to you, but how you get to people is certainly a much more broad-based thing than it's ever been. It seems to grow all the time. But the attention levels of people is much shorter. So therefore, your message must not only be there concisely, but when you're going to direct them, this is one of my little pet peeves today, is when you're going to direct somebody to someplace on the web to go get something, buy a pair of shoes or whatever it might be, send them to a landing page, send them to someplace where you can sell it. And I have arguments sometimes with some of my clients have over the years. They say, well, we want to send them to the website. Well, that's not good. It's like going out to go hire somebody to go do something when you don't know what it is that you're selling in a way. So if you want to sell that pair of shoes, take them to that pair of shoes. And sometimes what happens with some of the younger people that come into the market and try to attempt to do sales and marketing, they're not familiar with that approach, and they try to make it more broad-based, and that doesn't work today. You have to be very singular, you have to be very direct, and you have to have software that allows your database to work for you. Bill Gates made a comment a number of years ago, for example. He said, actually, I'll give you two quotes from Bill real quick. One I used in a video in the 90s when I did a video for one of the first web hosting companies. And he had a line that said, 5 years from now, meaning the year 2000, if you're in business and you don't have a website, you are not in business. That's a real important thing. And today, it's even more important that you have apps and all these different applications to make your business grow, to get to people, find different ways to get your business out there to people can see it, and they can see it in a hurry, and you can close your deals. So that's some of what you have to do on a daily basis. So it is some ways easier because you have a lot more information, but in other ways more difficult in terms of the competition you have and the methods that you must use to attract people and get them to see and appreciate and hopefully buy your product.
Great point, Rich. And the other thing I would throw in there is that the role of the CMO going back to from 2000 to today is dramatically different in what they control. The role of the CMO in 2000, they were probably building a website. They were probably doing some promotional stuff, and that's about it. The role of the CMO today is they control everything. They have the keys to the kingdom in terms of data, because CXOs on the operational and business side see data as a moneymaker. So I've submitted a presentation for the next Share conference, Jamie, talking about the tug of war of data between the CMO and the CIO. And what we're seeing in business today is that the business leaders and the operational people of these large enterprises see data as a moneymaker. And so they're giving the data over to the CMOs to use in their CRM and marketing automation systems. And there's a lot of risk there because marketing people don't understand data security very well. They certainly don't understand the compliance regulations that are put in place to manage the security of data. So in that regard, it's a much more difficult role today than it was in 2000 because there's so much risk. A data breach is going to cost a career now, and that career is not just the CIO as it was in 2005. It's going to be the CMO and the CEO in 2022.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And that actually ties into the second Bill Gates quote that I was going to mention. It was related to database, where he said if you're in business and you don't have a database that you maintain well, you are not in business or your business will fail. You know, today you must have a database, and your CMO, as you quite rightly say, has to understand how it works. They don't have to know it technically, but they have to know interfaces. They have to know that if you're going to do certain things and you're going to tie into certain things, you have to know about APIs. And that's when your CIO gets involved and your CTO and all the rest of it. So yeah, the keys to the kingdom is really a good way to put it. And I think today, I want to talk a little bit about COVID-19 and how it affected business as well. And maybe this is a time to get into that, if I might, because the CMO faces that aspect as well, because we talked earlier about what we used to call telecommuting. This relates to that as well, because that has grown dramatically as a result of COVID and provides more challenges from the CMO and the information people, because now you're having to use various different types of software. There's all sorts of sales types of software, Salesforce and others out there that help you in this way. But now it's far more intricate because the supervision of these people is now remote. And when you're putting 20-year-olds on the phone and you have to make sure that they are trained well, so you need software to do that. And then you have to make sure the software they're using interfaces in such a way that they can do their job easily. And the person they're talking to on the other side can do their business or do your business, the case may be. Well, that's not as easy as it might sound. And it just complicates the issues even more. So therefore, when you have that database, you want to make sure you got the right people saying the right things, connecting to the right software to make it a revenue generator, which it's supposed to be.
Rich, you brought up COVID-19. That was the big game changer, obviously, of the last few years. How did that affect, in your mind, the micro businesses, the solopreneurs, and how they'd approach things?
I've looked at it this way. I thought that one of the ironies of the pandemic is that the creation of this new home office business paradigm is really one of the amazing things that's happened. And so now, getting back to what I was saying a moment ago, is that there's myriad software out there that has enabled these opportunities to take hold and for people to make them successful. So it's really just someone that has the ambition to do it and want to do it, there's now more opportunities to do it than there ever were. And so companies that provide the types of software that enable, as I said a moment, that enable these things to happen fairly easily that didn't exist, say, just a handful of years ago, is where the opportunities are and where the challenges are. So when you're going to do that, if you're going to get into that, if I can jump into a little different area at the same time, not everybody knows how to start a business. In fact, most people don't. And I'm often asked, if you're going to start a business, what should I do? And what I like to recommend to people is, in almost every community, there are startup companies. In Miami, for example, when it's called Miami Ventures, well, they're everywhere. I've been to them in various cities around the country, and they are enormously helpful. They usually don't cost very much of any money at all. They usually run through local colleges or other things that have endowments. And you get to meet professionals and you learn a lot. So my first suggestion is take advantage of the opportunities, but go out and learn, because now, because of COVID, these operations are getting bigger and bigger and more and more. So if you really want to become successful, go learn a few things. Don't think you know everything. Assume that you know nothing and go out there, and that will give you the best chance to be successful. So as bad as the pandemic was and deadly it was, for unfortunately, and how many people it made ill, it has now caused this enormous change and how business is conducted. And my friends, that is not going to change. It is not going to suddenly go back to the way it was. That's not going to happen. We've now pushed past that. And while some people are taking down their plastic screens in their offices and such, otherwise, it's and masks are going away. But other than that, a lot of the stuff is going to remain the same. So this is going to continue. I've known some restaurants, for example, that now their servers don't take orders. They deliver food. You sit there and you take the iPad, you pick up the iPad and you place your order and do all that. So that's another example of another change. So that happened during COVID, and some of these places did it. So, you know, that kind of worked, and they're sticking with it. So that's just an example, but you're going to see it more and more and more as time goes on. So if you're thinking about becoming an entrepreneur, as Jamie said in the beginning, I have been one for a very long time, and it can be very rewarding and it can be very disappointing. I think you will learn more from your failures than you will your successes, but that's the great part about being an entrepreneur. But just make sure you train yourself correctly and go find the people that can help you. And they're out there and they can help you in many different ways. And most of them are related to software and database and how you generate revenue.
Those are good points, Rich. And I'm thinking back to your Bill Gates quote about, if you don't have a website, you don't have a business. I started doing website development in the mid 90s. I think there were less than 100,000 websites out there. And now there's several hundred million, I believe. But over the years, everybody has put a priority on their digital presence, not just the digital presence, but your digital reputation as well. And I think what happened with COVID-19 is that it amplified and sped up the companies, and especially the entrepreneur and solopreneur, the need to make yourself look bigger than you already are. We call it punch above your weight. That's one of the things we do really well in our company, is we can take a mom and pop in a garage and make them look like SAP. So what coronavirus did and what COVID-19 and work from home did was create all of these entrepreneurs and solopreneurs, many of them successful now, who've gone out and created these fantastic digital presences that look like big companies. And they may just be an assortment of contractors located all over the country, but they look like this integrated corporation. So I think COVID-19 has amplified that and really produced a lot of new small businesses and micro businesses. And I think that's good to see. We are all for the little guy competing against the software giants.
Well, I think one of the big differences that we haven't mentioned at this point between over the last 20 years, between 2009. We think back to the dot-com, what I call most of us call the dot-com fiasco, because of the lack of knowledge at the time. And just to refresh people's memory, you know, suddenly all this money was being invested with young people, and I'm not knocking young people necessarily, but people that didn't know that what they were doing, but they had an idea. And because people were looking at the money and they thought they could make a fortune in banner ads, and what was created would amount to a false model. And people invested and ultimately lost millions in this model. And because what the people were doing, they were taking all this money suddenly where they had nothing. They had millions of dollars. They were going out and buying fancy tables and chairs, and their office place were all built out and this and that, and instead of working out of their garage, just to give them this big giant look, but they had nothing underneath. Today, thanks to a lot of companies, if I can say like yours, Tony, is that people are able to build up their business correctly. It doesn't matter where it is. It can be in your home. Who cares? Nobody cares anymore. And the money is going into the things that it can go into. So there's, as I said earlier, between the entrepreneur startup things you can get into, all sorts of things, learn about what you're going to do. Do not go out and spend your money on tables and chairs. Go figure out what you're going to do, get the help that you need, and then you have a much better chance of being successful. And there's a lot of people, if I can say, like myself and like Tony and Jamie, that have been around for a while, that are more than willing to step in and show you things to do. And everybody wants to be successful. And I think people that have been entrepreneurs like myself and you guys really want other entrepreneurs to have that same feeling and have that same success. There's nothing better than doing that. I don't consider myself in sales, but the reality is I'm in sales and so is everybody else. Everybody is, you know, and so how do you take advantage of that is the difference between everybody. And to have that, not what I was going with that thought was, is that when you make a good sale and you've convinced somebody of your expertise and they agree to do business with you, that to me is the greatest feeling in the world. And only entrepreneurs and people that go out and sell something and promote something and have that success have that feeling. And I love it when people have that feeling. And I try to share with as many people as I can.
Yeah, and jumping on your point about young people and entrepreneurs in the early 2000s, not really knowing what they're doing. I don't think anybody knew what they were doing back then, regardless of if they were young or old or whatever, because the internet was so new and there were no tools to measure anything. I talk a lot about marketing being a business of mistakes, and that's okay because it's kind of like baseball. When you're batting 300, you're really successful. And I think marketing is the same. You just have to have the tools and the technologies to understand what's working and what's not working. And they really didn't have that back in the early 2000s. And I wonder, just listening to you talk about these things, Rich, I wonder how much that affected the emergence of Salesforce.com and HubSpot and all of these other CRM and marketing automation tools that manage data and manage contacts and manage lead generation to give you metrics on the marketing promotions and programs you're doing. How successful are those and how poorly are those doing? And that's what, and really in a nutshell, what marketing is, just doing things, understanding the metrics of those things, continuing to do the things that are working and stop doing the things that aren't working. And the companies that are successful have technologies that measure the things that they're doing when they're marketing and when they're doing promotions, and they understand, well, this didn't work, I'm not going to do that anymore. The companies that don't do it very well will just continue to make mistakes, and because they don't have data and they don't have metrics on what's working and what's not working, they continue to do the things that's not working. Good points. And I think a lot of the emergence of Salesforce and all the accompanying products that compete with Salesforce on CRM and marketing automation side were probably born out a lot of those mistakes from the dot-com boom.
I don't know, there's no question about that. We watched them grow and we found things that simply weren't there. I was one of the early buyers, for example, of keywords, something probably most people have forgotten all about by now, to a certain extent. But when I was buying them from Google way back in the day, talking about in the early 2000s, I was paying, I think, 10 cents, literally. 10 to 15 cents was the most I paid for anything. So we had a bill of maybe $1,100 at the time the month was over, and we had a ton of stuff out there. So that's the other side of it. A lot of there were marketing opportunities then. There are far greater, obviously, now, and the tracking of them and making them work can be difficult. An example I'll give you in one of my businesses called Spina Systems. We had it for 5 years. We were selling basically to doctors, surgeons, piece of equipment. It was six-figure, it was a fairly expensive piece of equipment. And there, we were probably the first company to use the internet the way we did. Our first site went up in 2001. I was already doing sites, started doing sites in the late 90s. My first experience was with De Beers, the Diamond people. I think we were in the earlies into e-tailing. And I learned a lot through that process, working with J. Walter Thompson, those people in New York who were ahead of the game in terms of that. But the point is, when we got into our site, I already had a lot of insight as to what to do. And one of them was to find myself a good designer and a good developer, because they're not the same person. This is when you talk about mistakes that companies make and why they continue. That's one of them. They will try to do one person do that, and they are different people. As an example, and the result was, we had a very powerful site that worked very well, and we used customers to sell to other customers, a point you made earlier. I wanted to come back to that. That is so important. Testimonials still work today, even when they say on TV, actor portrayals, they still work. I don't know why, but they do. There's something about a person telling, I did this, and it was so. So in the case of with Spines, it was doctors Doctors who were successful with the machine were making money, and the most importantly, the patients were getting better. So their two most important things, the wellness of the patients and the wellness of their practice, were the two most important things. Nothing else mattered. So we addressed that every way that we possibly could, identified that, and that's what we hummed in on, and that's what marketeers have to do. And when in today's CMO finds that a much greater challenge than it's ever been, because where you just had a handful of media to deal with, now you have a staggering amount of media to deal with, multiple languages, all different sorts of ways to do landing pages in different directions, depending on, there is so much more to do and to track that it's far more challenging to do that. But at the same time, you can be greatly successful. So you can have great failures, but as you indicate, you always have failures. There's always failures, and you learn from those failures and you grow out of it. As I said earlier, learn more from the failures and do your successes. So successes keep you going, and you just keep working the trail as you go down it.
Thank you. Let's talk about some of the struggles that you had in terms of people and processes and systems over the years, and how those failures or struggles turned into success for you.
Well, I would say there's a couple of different aspects to that. One is technology itself. In the period, I like to refer, there was a period of about 15 to 20 years in the transition in the video game from analog to digital. This was extraordinarily painful and expensive. Equipment was changing, formats were changing rapidly. People were investing millions of dollars and found out within a year that they were out of date. I mean, it was a very difficult time. And so it's not so much a failure, it's just in trying to prepare and go and produce the materials that you need. So in looking at businesses and trying to make those decisions as to which way to go, sometimes you're not sure. And you have to go with what's there. And hope for the best, quite frankly. I don't know if I'm quite answering your question, but I'm trying to get there. That was the most difficult problem that we faced in the various businesses. I worked with one company that was early into computers and doing things for insurance companies that weren't done before. So there was a lot of newness. What Tony was indicating or inferring a few moments ago, there's a lot of newness. And how does this work and how does it not work and what's the best way to go? So I would say some failures would have been related to some aspects of trying to seek an audience. I would say one of my first businesses I helped build was called the University of Rasco, the University of Miami. It was a beer and wine place and restaurant on campus built in 1972. The reason I mentioned that one is because everybody came in. This is going way, way, way back, but it's an example of what can happen. The atmosphere in the country, we're still in the Vietnam War and a lot of things going on. The draft was bad. I don't want to get into the whole thing, but the point is they looked at this place as a place people could go to and resolve their differences and so on and so on. It was a very difficult time, but that didn't work out. Simply because you can't start traditions overnight. So it became a process, and it took us months to figure out the testing and try this and try that, and having the support of the people and even the boss coming in one day and see when we're 50 grand in the hole and saying, guys, I know you're confident you can do it. So we redid our thing. We changed everything and we turned it into a success by the following September. And that was in 1973. And here in 2022, it is still up and running today. Wow. One of my accomplishments, one of my legacies to me, that I'm very proud of. And that's a long time. And that, to me, that catapulted me to where I am today. We came from being told that either you guys fix this in March. I'll never forget this, guys. In March of 73, I would sit down at a table with the president of the company and then said, if you guys can't fix this, we're going to take this building over. The president's going to take it as a new office. And that's it. No more Rascal. So that was the pressure we were under. And I'm only 22 years old at this time. So it was a great way to learn and go from there. So I've always kept that in my mind, is that you have, if something is not working, go figure out why it's not working. Don't just throw it away. Go look at it. It failed for a reason. There's always a reason. And then you learn from that. And the next time it's better. And I have done that. So we did that. And there's other instances where we were, even in the spina business, in the medical business, we were a very slow start, very slow start. But once we got it going, we saw what the doctors wanted, how they wanted to approach it. We knew what to do. We changed it. We changed the website, and it began to grow. And that's the essence of being the CMO. You have to be flexible. You have to be thinking. You have to be looking ahead. You have to see what else is going on in the marketplace, what people are planning to do, and try to be at the forefront. And when you see something that someone else is doing, said, That works for them. Why does it work for them? Can I make it work for me? We're great copycats. And we should be. If something is working, go make it work for you.
Yeah, you just said something there that I think is very important, Rich, is getting feedback from the user and feedback from the customer. And in iterations, right? You do a little bit of something, you get feedback. You update what you were working on. You do a little more, you get feedback, you update it. You do a little more, you get feedback, you update it. This is the concept of the DevOps, the software development methodology in Agile. Where previously, before Agile and DevOps, people would just build these huge systems, these huge software application systems, and they would only get the feedback at the end. And sometimes the feedback would be good, and sometimes the feedback would be terrible. And if it's terrible and you spend a year developing an application, you got to go back. Yeah, so doing a little bit, getting feedback, updating, fixing, doing a little, getting feedback. And then also when you're building something, whether it's a website or an application or whatever, getting requirements and getting an understanding of how it's going to be deployed and used in the end product. That's very good. And I know you have some experience at that with user acceptance testing and training. And I think that's a very important thing to bring out as well, is understanding what the user wants, getting that feedback along the journey, not just at the end of the application process.
I think I mentioned De Beers earlier, and one of the things that they used to do is they would have, and this was not unique to them by any means, but they would have panel discussions. I would go to New York and we would tape these sessions that they would have with people they would find in the street, if you will, just ordinary people, to ask some very specific questions. And this ultimately led them to certain products, in some cases, they would design based on people's needs so that they weren't working in a vacuum. That's number one. And how to orient their marketing as well. So it was two main things that they got out of that. They found out what people wanted, what you were just saying. They found out what people wanted, number one, and how they wanted it to be sold to them. Now, how interesting is that? That's why I say learn a lot from these people, and they would begin to design. And I'll give you one example. They came up with something. Everything you see in diamond sales, for example, show how powerful they have been over their careers, now successful. Everything you see, clarity, color, all those things you see in the stores and the signs, all this, all about that. That was all an invention by De Beers, every bit of it. And thing they called, the first one I was involved with them, which I think was in 99, was they introduced something they called the three stone products. So it really began with rings. They still make them today. And I remember we did it in 99, and at the big show in 2001, it was 2 years later, they announced with 2,000 people, their wholesale salespeople from around the world, that globally, in that 2 year period, they had sold $2.1 billion worth of three stone products. And they came from an idea generated in a panel discussion. And they came with past, present, and future, and this and that. It's a whole, I don't want to get in the whole backstory with it, but you get the idea. And that's why it is so critical. Just because somebody says, that's a nice widget. Yeah, you should sell that. Okay. How do you do that? That's where the game begins.
Yeah, good point.
Tony, I think you had a great idea. Let's play a little game called What Would Rich Rudd Do?
you know
you achieved a certain level of success, Rich, when they want to name a game after you. So first, second, and third. Rich, if you started a new business in 2022 in terms of the order of things, people, process, systems, how would you approach it today?
Well, I think the first thing, obviously, somebody has shown you a product of some sort of service, product or service. And I think the first thing is determine what it is. What is this product? Okay, that's what it does. Second, do people need this product? What do they need it for? If they need it, then maybe they'll buy it. And third, if you think they'll buy it, how will you market it to them? How will you accomplish that? Those are the three things, just one, two, three. And all of them take some time. But that would be the order of business for me. And once you've established that, then maybe as part of the third, I would then seek out who can help me do this. Maybe it's fourth. That's where the support companies come in. That's where the startup helpers come in. Who can help me do this? Because I can't do it myself. Even if, and particularly if you think that you can, I'm telling you right now, you cannot. You know, the odds of you doing it all by yourself are between slim and none. So you need to get help. And that's how I would do it. And those people will help you determine that process. Those people will help you determine the process and the systems you need to move that product out the door and make some money.
Great answer, Rich. Yeah. I've seen many a company fail that had a great product and the right idea, but didn't have the right people. Or they had a great leader who created the idea and created the company and the brand, and then they get it to a certain level where that person just can't go beyond that. And it's a great point doing that homework out front. There's an organization called Pragmatic Marketing that has taken a lot of what the Mad Men did, the old Don Draper stuff in the 50s and 60s, and applied it to selling software and software technology related services in the 2000 and the 2010s. And part of that pragmatic model is don't create your brochure or your website until you do all of this stuff out front, your research, feasibility, what's needed in the marketplace, how are you going to sell it, how are you going to deploy it. And then after you do all of that legwork, then you're going to create a piece of collateral that recaps all of this research and learning that you've done that may have taken years. And what we see a lot in companies that do it poorly, that don't succeed, is they'll have an idea and then some CEO will go, okay, now I need a brochure. And this guy we showed this to, it looked great. He's the CIO of Bank of America. You know, well, we're going to sell a million of these. Go get me a brochure and let's sell a million of them. And like you say, you've got to do that legwork. It takes time. It takes effort.
If you fail to do it, then, and you go out and you make this brochure because the boss wants it, or you go build a website or do any of these things without the proper information, what you end up doing is you're going to end up doing the whole thing, looking at it and say, this is all wrong. Ultimately, you have to redo the whole thing. And once you get to that point, you may be out of money.
Yep. And
the angel fund, you know, typically when I was doing the presentations to investors, well, there's different groups of investors, as you all know, and there's angel investors, for example, who you really don't want to do business with unless you absolutely have to. But that's another story, and other groups. But everyone has the same idea. Sell me something. Make me want to buy this product. And I have done probably 15 or 20 of these presentations in my life. And ultimately, and particularly when you're new and you're not generating revenue, which is where what we're talking about here, you haven't generated a nickel yet. You got to be able to prove something to somebody that you can do that. And the only way you can do that is by doing the research that you were talking about and I'm talking about. It just doesn't happen any other way. And oftentimes, when we talked a little earlier, I'd like to go to another point that's kind of, it's a little bit of a sore point with me, but I've gotten over it. Back around the 2010s, business began to slack off some for a variety of reasons. A lot of young people, we're beyond the dot-com thing now, but there began this another wave where it was difficult for when you're 50 years old to find work. The point I'm getting at is that I had to come in, I ended up being an expert fixing things, and I did it for several companies. Redid their training manuals, redid their customer service applications and a number of different things because they brought in young people who were active and smart and wanted to hustle and do business. They were good people, but they didn't have the background and they didn't have the knowledge. They were all over the road and they had a really good product and they could sell it, but then they had trouble supporting it. And so I ended up making a bunch of money just stepping in and doing these steps that you and I are talking about right now and coming back and fixing them and keeping those companies afloat. So that became another type of business. So you have to look around. If things aren't going your way, go figure out why and then go fix it. And if you are an entrepreneur and you want to be successful and you don't want to be flipping burgers your whole life, that's what you do.
Rich, what is your advice to the solopreneur trying to do everything? If you only have 12 hours in a day to work, you should make sure you do X every day to be successful.
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say first and foremost, it's almost impossible to do things totally by yourself. I don't think anybody can. I don't care how many days and hours in a day you work. You have to bring in other resources to help you through it, whether it's a printer or a way. I'll give examples. Everybody pretty much knows that. But that would be a heck of an effort. And I've been on my own for a long time, but I still use lots of other people to help me do what I need to do. So that's my answer to that. But as far as what to do every day, I have found that communication, which is my expertise more than anything else, than every form you could possibly imagine, is the key. And I know every single day, this may sound a little silly, but when we had the larger companies, part of my staff's job every day was to make sure the internet was connected, that our speed was right, that the email systems were working, that our auto responses were working. If someone called and got the voicemail, that they got the right messages and got turned to the right thing. Because you can't tell me times that things fail from time to time. And if you're not calling into an office, for example, and somebody doesn't tell you your voicemail doesn't work, or it sent me to here, or something's wrong, people get frustrated. If the website has got an issue, maybe you need to find, you need to do something to increase your broadband, whatever. Give you examples till the cows come home. But that aspect, making sure all your lines of communication are open, that's what I literally do, and I still do it every day at a much smaller scale, to make sure that you can be successful, that people can communicate with you, and then check and make sure everything, like I said, make sure everything's working, and then go to town and follow up on your leads and follow up on whatever your project management software may be telling you to do, or whatever the case may be.
Rich, from the buyer perspective, what advice can you give to the small business owner for what to primarily watch for, something you've got to remember every day when you get out of bed?
I'll tell you something. I occasionally lecture on brand marketing. And one of the things I talk about is that there are only two rules of marketing, two and two only. Everything else is an offshoot of. And one thing is what marketing is always about. And the second thing is what marketing is never about. Marketing is never about reality. It's always phased a little bit. It's not exactly reality. So if it's not reality, what is it? Well, marketing is always about perspective. And perspective, from a buyer standpoint, really can almost never be appreciated by the seller, because the seller has other concerns. The business owner has other concerns. So the buyer is the only one that sees it looking from the outside in, which is very difficult to do as a business owner. So you need to have people telling you things. You need to kind of get out of your chair, in a sense, and go look and see what the buyer is seeing. Does that make sense? When I say I'm a user advocate, that is part of that. And in fact, it's a major part of that, when I think about it. Because when I go through a site, that's what I'm seeing. What does the user see? Does this make sense to them? They want to buy that pair of shoes. Oh, there they are. They're not. I don't have to go look for them. So if you suddenly go to, you're selling this pair of shoes, and what does the customer see? Oh, here's my page, and here's all those shoes. Where's the shoes he was talking about? Oh, they're not even here. Oh, I better fix that. That's what we're talking about. Go look at it. Go see what you're doing. Go figure it out. Go find out why, what we said earlier, go find out why the customer is not happy. If you can figure that out and address it, you have a much better chance of being successful. And that's what you need to remember. When you get out of bed every day, go figure out why your buyers are buying or why they're not, and address that concern.
Great point. We talk a lot about that in win-loss analysis and understanding why somebody bought something, and almost as important, sometimes more important, why they didn't buy something. And in the enterprise software space and regulated industries like banking, finance, healthcare, government, these software cycles could take 12, 18 months, sometimes 2 years. I've heard of deals taking 2 years to close. And if you think about all the man hours that you've had over that time frame, it's really important to know, if you lose that deal, why you lost it. And this is that ability to get outside looking in. And the other thing I would advise, if you're a company that wants to do a win-loss analysis, don't do it internally, because nobody wants to see their ugly baby. Nobody wants to look at the warts. You know, so you need to get a third party to come in and do that win-loss analysis. And Rich, those are words of wisdom. Get out of your chair and try to see what the customer is seeing, and try to see your business from not your perspective.
Yeah, it's absolutely critical. And it applies to every business. I'm sitting here trying to think of any business that would not apply to, and I don't care what it is. You must have the interrelationship direct with your clientele. And there's a separation that occurs after the point of sale. And what a smart business does is they never lose that contact. One way or another, they keep moving it until the customer says, go away. But that's the appropriate use of a database. And that's why it's so critical to have the right type of software. And unless you're really, really a big company and happen to really get lucky and find somebody who's really smart and knows all sorts of things, and you can afford to pay them $250,000 a year, then you're fine. But that's not the average person. And even some things, I'll give you one example. The recent bank merger between Truist and SunTrust has been one of the great IT screw-ups of our time. These guys are having a hell of a time. And my point simply is this: these are enormous companies with an awful lot of money, and yet they ran into a problem. Because I was affected a little bit by one of their problems when they took over BB&T, This is what happened. The BB&T transition was easy because they used the same platforms. When they went to go bring SunTrust into the same routine, they couldn't use the same platform. So they had to bring a new, which means obviously you guys know APIs. And APIs, what made me think of this when you talk about APIs, APIs can take weeks or months or a year to develop. They are tricky depending on what you're doing. I can't technically do them, but I just know how they work. And they simply didn't do that. And the result was, it was a disaster. And they're still trying to recover from it all this time later. So that shows, despite the size of the company, all the money that they had, and the people that, my best guess is, the IT people said, do it this way, and it costs this. And the top people said, well, do this anyway, but don't spend that. And which we run into all the time. And as a result, they got problems. And they've been terribly embarrassed. The customers having to walk into branches and say, my cards don't work anymore. Stuff like that. But it's part of what we have today. We have the opportunities today to get into business. And I think are greater than they've ever been. But because of software applications, for no other reason, that there's, if you want to do it, you can do it. As we've said continually here, there's people out there to help you. There's businesses to help you. There's software that can help you. There's so different things that you can operate solely and operate remotely and all those sorts of things. And that's going to, opportunities are continue to grow. And that's what, if I was going into business today, that's what I would look to do, take advantage of everything I possibly can, because it's all out there for you, every bit of it.
Guys, that's all the time we have for today. Rich, Tony, thanks for joining us. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Hope you enjoyed today's conversation as much as I did. Please visit us at perrymarketing.com, subscribe to our podcast, and join us again next month. We will talk again. Thanks, and have a great day.
Be sure to join us next month for another episode of Tips from the Top. And you can always visit perrymarketing.com for our podcast archive and other sales and marketing content to help you sell more software.